Hey. Hey. Hi everyone. Lokonono is asking to address up for work every day. That's so funny. Some days, when I'm in the mood. Hi, can you guys hear me? Hi everyone, so nice to see you. So we're just waiting for Angela to join us. How's everybody's day been? Is it just me or is it getting like cold? Oh, I can see Angela's joined us. Hi. It's cold, ne? Heesh, don't get my scarf, Miss Bianchi. Hi.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. Did I catch you complaining about the weather?
Slightly. I'm just like, when did it get so cold, guys? Wow.
It's winter, it's May. It's time.
Also, time just feels like a very abstract concept, thanks to
Is
COVID, right? Like, I don't even,
COVID-19.
if it wasn't for work, I honestly wouldn't even know what day it is.
Oh, are you going to work daily?
So I'm working from home. I feel like I'm
Yeah.
working more now than I did at the office.
Oh no, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Zoom meetings. Zoom meetings.
I officially dislike Microsoft Teams.
Oh shit.
And
Oh my goodness. Oh wow. Okay, Microsoft Teams.
just like calls, do you know what I mean? I never knew I needed to hear people's voices like 10 times a day. So I'm going
Oh
through
my
it. And
goodness.
how have you been? Have you been working from home?
I've been working from home, but since yesterday, my team has been coming in small numbers, so we've got like a schedule. So we just, trying to kind of control it and contain it and minimize contact and all that stuff that we now all have to get used to.
And what's the vibe been like? Are people like happy to come back because there's some human contact or?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. I think we've been conducting meetings online the entire time. So yesterday was actually the first kind of official stroke, unofficial day back at work. So some people are saying, "Shoo, it's such a breath of fresh air to just be in a different environment, you know?" So yeah, I suppose people are all different, but I think it does get to you just being contained, within your home. 24/7, it's a very tough life. It's very difficult to adjust to.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you also don't realize how much people are saying we also use Microsoft Teams to teach online. I don't mind Teams. I do mind the never ending TCs. If we didn't have as many teleconferences on Teams, I just wouldn't mind. I wouldn't mind
Yeah.
Microsoft Teams.
Yeah.
But I don't know why. I feel like everyone wants to have more meetings than they'd ordinarily have. I don't know if you've felt that way as well.
Yeah, I was joking to a friend of mine. I was saying that, you know, somebody who worked in government used to say to me, attending meetings is a KPI in their workplace. And like, she's like, yeah, no, now during lockdown, it looks like attending, key, att like the more meetings you attend, the more likely you're gonna get a bonus if such a thing still actually exists in this world, you know?
Okay, then maybe I should stop complaining about meetings.
KPI, darling, it's a KPI. Attend those meetings and look happy, look enthusiastic, you know?
We haven't been doing video, which I've been grateful for because my hair under this is just it's a
I
lot.
know, hair's a big problem. I had an afro for quite a while, and yeah, it was wild. So I just switched off the video because I was thinking my afro's not looking good. I'm trying, but the hairline issues, all of that wonderful stuff.
Right, and people are like, let's have video. I'm like, let's not have
Let's
video.
just deal with audio. It's enough. I mean, we're here
Can you
to talk
imagine?
about what we need to do. We don't need to be seeing each other's faces.
No, it's okay. I'm like, we all know how we look. It's okay. We just need
Yes.
video.
And we don't need to see how we look in real life when we're at home wearing pajamas, you know,
Yeah, my
with no
mom judged me
makeup.
the other day. She called me at like 10 and I was in my pajamas. She's like, how can you be in your pajamas at this time? I'm like, girl, bye. We're all going through it,
You're
bye.
like, what am I dressing up to go to? You know, I mean, really, the kitchen, the lounge, there's only so much, you know.
Also, you know, maybe it's okay to just enjoy being able to be in your pajamas at 10 o'clock on a work day. Can I just.
Can you imagine what it's going to be like when we're all back in? If, well, I mean, obviously, we are all going to go back to our real world at some point, but you know, I think it'll be awkward for a lot of people because you know, you just become accustomed to just being yourself and not really doing any high maintenance stuff, you know, because you just have your few people around you, your family or your whoever it is that you live with. So I think the new normal is going to be staggering, and I don't think
I
people will be
don't even
rushing
know if
to
I'll still
restaurants
be
and
able
stuff.
to wear my work clothes because I have not been social distancing from the fridge.
From the
So
food, Noah, join the crowd.
I was just like, oh my goodness, my work clothes are just like looking at me like, are you sure you wanna, are you sure, girl? Yeah, look, I don't even drink, but I think that I need a social distance from chocolates, you know?
Just lock it, just get a big lock and just, you know,
Like
put on
those
the lock pad.
old school things. Anyway, before I get carried away, welcome everyone to another episode of The Lockdown with the Cheeky Natives. We have the amazing Angela Makhola Moabelo today. I am actually going to read her bio before we get started. I know everyone has lots and lots of questions, especially about some of her earlier
I can't believe
books.
Sugiswas just said I've got a cup of. She says, "I bet you have wine in that cup of tea."
So do you have wine? Do you have wine? Angela, you're one of the few who still has wine.
You're gonna have to prove it. You're gonna have to come here and prove what is in the very large cup.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure there's lots of tea in that mug. So I'm super excited. I'm quite excited to welcome onto the Cheeky Natives, Angela Makhola Moabelo. From an early age, Angela Makhola harbored dreams of becoming a storyteller. Her love for the written word saw her first short story being published at the age of 13 in the popular youth publication, Upbeat magazine. From that moment, the bug had bitten. Angela went on to graduate as a journalism major at Rhodes University and practiced as a journalist for several years before starting her own PR and events management company, Bright Spark Communications, in 2002. Her debut novel, Red Ink, is a crime thriller set in Johannesburg, which was published to both public and critical acclaim in 2007. This was followed by The 30th Candle, a book that revolves around university friends who navigate their way to their 30th birthdays with humorous and sometimes unexpected results. The Black Widow Society, published in 2013, follows the cloak and dagger workings of a secret society of middle-class Black women who plot to eliminate their errant husbands through devious and underhanded means, giving fresh meaning to the words, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." Angela's most recent novel, The Blessed Girl, is a satirical novel told from the perspective of a young woman who engages in transactional relationships with married men in order to access the opulent lifestyle she believes she deserves. Angela has gained both critical and popular acclaim for her contribution to African literature and has been nominated for several literary awards. The crime and women's fiction writer has been invited to speak at a number of local and international literary events and is committed to the advancement of literature on the African continent. She works with a number of young South African writers to encourage the love of reading among township and rural youth through various initiatives such as Read SA. Angela Makwala is currently working on her fifth fictional title.
I've got
Yeah. Okay, so
the
Angela has a
manuscript
manuscript, so you already know it's going down. Welcome, welcome once again. Sure, you know, I have like 5 million things that I'm sure I want to ask you and lots of people want to ask you because we just have so much that we can discuss about your amazing journey as a writer. But before we start, can I ask you to please read from The Blessed Girl, those pages that we spoke about. And for those of you who have the novel, you have to guess which page she's reading from. Jokes.
Oh no. I've read so many times on this page. I was trying to avoid it. You know that.
No, you can't. This is the page, Angela. This
That
page
gives
states,
the
Inali
context to
that
everything.
thing. Inali that thing.
Inanimate
That thing.
thing. All right. Okay, I'll indulge you. So the Blessed Girl, as you've outlined, is about, you know, our young lady Bonke Tau. She's living kind of the high life in, you know, cosmopolitan Johannesburg. So this is kind of an
Yes,
introductory
girl.
chapter where we get to know who she is, and you know, she's bragging. She's really kind of laying it on very thick to the readers so that they understand who they're dealing with, Ms. Bonke Tau. So she says, "My name is Bonke Tau. The first thing you will notice about me is my honeycomb complexion, my almond-shaped eyes, the mole on the right corner of my mouth, and my luscious lips. From a very young age, I knew that I was exceptionally beautiful. I saw it in the way that adults looked at me, the compliments showered upon my mother for my good looks, the way that grown men would just stop and gape at me. At school, teachers would give me a free pass on tasks that were expected of other children. From the moment I was born, my parents knew that I was destined to go far, purely because of the way that I looked. Hence, they named me Bonk, the beautiful one. It doesn't hurt that my name Tau means lion. I'm a beautiful and fierce lion. Watch out, world. People don't understand that when your physical attributes are the most exceptional things about you, the sun orbits around your world instead of the other way around. If I were given the option to spend a lifetime as Albert Einstein or Marilyn Monroe, I choose Marilyn Monroe every time, drugs and all. I think that despite some of her bad choices, she still had so much quality of life. And that weird looking chemist, or was he a scientist? Ugh, whatever. I just love girls who know how to make the most of their looks. Marilyn Monroe was the original Blessie, and you can quote me on that one. When
Yes,
I
please.
realized, was that, were you saying something?
No, I'm having a moment with Windling.
You're having a moment. Okay, when I realized that most people were willing to let me get away with just about anything because of my looks, I learned to manipulate. No, let's just call it take advantage of situations. And, you know, as collateral damage, I sometimes also learn to take advantage of people. I don't really care about people who judge me. It's mostly the ones who haven't made it, who haven't made anything of their lives anyway. Average people tend to be average at just about everything they do. And exceptional people tend to excel at least one or two things in life. The skill that I have honed and perfected from a very young age is that of charming people to get my way. Malcolm Gladwell said that if you spend 10,000 hours honing a skill, if you practice incessantly at it, you are most likely to be a champion in that field. I've been charming the pants of people from the day I was born. At school, when I didn't feel like attending classes, I would get a boy in class to take notes for me, and even go as far as to come through to my ask them to come through to my house to update me on everything that I had missed in class. When I realized how easy it was to convince people, especially boys, to do what I wanted, I decided that that was how I was going to cruise my way through life. People think that my lack of academic prowess makes me dumb, but they just don't understand that I'm smarter than they are. I apply an 80-20 principle in the way that I've lived my life. 20% effort for 80% reward. This philosophy has ensured that I notch up the kind of successes that most people my age only dream about. One day, I'm going to get someone to write a book about my philosophy on life. Then there's a lot of poor souls that would benefit from my simple yet highly effective outlook. I'm currently 24 years old. I own two businesses, a fully paid-up penthouse on Grayson Drive in Sandton, right at the heart of Johannesburg's swanky metropolis, and I drive a luxury vehicle, a convertible, no less. Not bad for a girl from Mamelodi. Yep, that's my hood, baby. I barely scraped through matric, and I've never spent a single day in a university lecture hall. But what I lack in academic qualifications, I more than make up for in my street smarts. My role model is Donald Trump. This one makes me cringe. My role model is Donald Trump. The only books in my house are motivational treasures by the likes of my hero, Donald Trump, Richard Branson, and books about how to manipulate men. I really love those. I think anyone who's dumb enough to study psychology should actually stop wasting their time and just read books like Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, or Why Men Love Bitches. Oh yes, I have a PhD in mancology, baby. That's
Yes. Okay.
it.
Quinta, we have Carter. Carter's girl. Carter's. Wait again. I read convertible in Samson. Hello. Come on, somebody. So before we even talk about Bunte, because you know as Bunte. Bunte is an interesting character. I mean, this is you've not just finished your first novel, but at the time this was book number four. And that's a triumph for anybody, particularly a black woman publishing in South Africa, knowing what our publishing industry is like, right? So, I mean, I'm really curious about what you think of the evolution of your journey from Red Ink to now having written Blessed Girl and what it means to for you to have had four books about black women and black women's stories in an industry such as the one that we have in South Africa.
I think I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it in that context necessarily. It's more, when I think about my writing journey, I reflect back on myself as a young black girl living in the township. I grew up in Tembisa in the East Rand, and I remember I was always fascinated by books. I mean, I lived inside book pages, like most of us who are book lovers. And I remember, I think I must have been around, it must have been around that time, around 13 or 14, when I kind of had this inkling that this is something that, well, writing is something that I would love to do one day. But the minute kind of that thought was ingrained in my mind, it felt impossible. It felt like it's a dream that I will never achieve, because there were just not that many books, or at least I did not have access to books written by Black African women, Black South African women. As much as I was surrounded by literature, because my father kind of went out of his way to expose us to a lot of books. He was an English teacher, but it was mostly English literature. And if it wasn't English literature, then I went through that phase where you discovered your James Hadley Chase that I think we all kind of managed to sneak into our little corners and read while our parents are not aware, that we're not mindful that we're reading that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it just seemed very far-fetched. And so looking at my life now, it's 2020 and I've written, well, four books and I'm on my fifth novel. I suppose it is quite, I'm kind of dumbstruck by it in a way. If I look if I look back at myself and where I was at that time and just how impossible it seemed. It just seemed like something that you couldn't even dream about as a young black girl. It really didn't, you know. So I guess I feel blessed, you know, to have the opportunity to do this. Yeah.
So I love your books because you're writing about women that I can see, that I can relate to, because it's women who live like me, women who've had sort of similar stories or similar journeys. I was thinking of 30th Candle, and now I am very close to 30, you know, and like when I first read it, I was like, oh my God, 30 is so old. Now I'm close to 30.
People are so pathetic.
And I'm like, yo, that girl, these people, wow, you know, because you think at 30, you'll have it together, you know.
Yeah.
These are women who are also really relatable, just your characters, even in Red Ink, right? Or like the Black Widow Society. These are Black women who are relatable, right? So I mean, I guess you've spoken about it a little bit, but I just want to expand a little bit on that idea of why you particularly write about these kinds of women, right? That I feel like we all, are they based on women that you know? Do you base it on your friends? How do you decide on your characters, I guess? But also, to add on to that question, what do you feel about the tag of chick lit, right? I was having a conversation with a friend, you know, and they were saying, I want a light book, you know, chick lit. But there's this feeling that chick lit or women writing about themselves or other women is a light read. It's not a serious genre, right? And I guess this may be something that you've also encountered in your own writing or people's perceptions of your writing.
We're taking a short break.
Are you a Caribbean American? Are you looking for a podcast that truly speaks to your culture and identity? Look no further than Carry On Friends, the ultimate destination for all things Caribbean American, hosted by me, Carrie Ann. Dive deep into topics such as culture, heritage, and everyday life through the unique lens of the Caribbean American experience. You'll walk away feeling more connected to your roots. Follow and listen on Apple Podcasts so you'll never miss an episode of Carry On Friends, the Caribbean American experience. Your Caribbean American community awaits.
Yeah, I think, you know, the label of chick lit, I mean, I'm happy to say that it's slowly eroding. It's really fading away. I would say that the only title of mine that I would hear people refer to as chick lit would be 30th Candle. And I think it's because at that time, you know, that label was still being bandied about. But right now, if you think about literature, I think, you know, if you go into a bookshop, in as far as new writing is concerned, I would say that women probably make up almost about 50% of the kind of literature that's available. And also, more critically, that readers are by and large, especially readers of fiction, are by and large women, especially in South Africa. I mean, whenever I speak to readers at different platforms, at festivals and things like that, there's usually, you know, the majority of people that are represented there are females. So it's a very ridiculous title because, you know, the kind of fiction or the kind of literature that I write is so different from any number of my fellow female writers who are writing at this moment. I mean, I've got Sisonke's book in front of me, Always Another Country. I mean, that's obviously nonfiction. It tackles so the topics, the you know, the subject matter is so different from what I tackle. So I think it's very dismissive and very disrespectful to try and you know, put us in a little corner like that. And it's actually quite ridiculous. It's a very outdated concept. In terms of the characters that I write about, I mean, I like the fact that, you know, my characters, well, I like writing about people who are not perfect, who haven't got this life thing sorted, you know. I like to reflect on strong women. They've got it together in the sense that a lot of them have a sense of purpose and a fairly good sense of who they are, but they are on a journey. They're kind of on some kind of journey of discovery. With Lucy, it was she was kind of in a messy relationship, and she was making this transition from one career to another. She was a single mom, and she was kind of traversing her personal life and her own kind of career ambitions to be, you know, she was merging a period in her life where she's moving from being an investigative journalist to being a business owner, but at the same time having these ambitions to write a book. And she chose kind of a strange subject matter, a serial killer. And so we kind of went through that journey with her, with all its ups and downs and its thrills. And I enjoyed writing a thriller, especially because there weren't that many thriller, you know, African thriller titles at the time. And I love reading thriller titles. I'll show you even with my little collection. I've got lots of thrillers here, both local and international. So that was, you know, it was gratifying to be able to tackle that kind of subject matter. Because also, I think at that time, when I was younger, the other way in which African writers were pigeonholed was that we were kind of seen as activists more than writers. So if you're an African writer, you were expected in a way to reflect on, you know, our politics, which was important at the time and is important right now. But I think that it's also unfair to expect every African writer to be an activist or to be somebody who's kind of politically very vocal, because I think as human beings, we are not just made up by our politics. We are made up by a lot of things. We're made up by our socioeconomics. We're made up by, you know, our private lives and the kind of choices we make as individuals. And so I thought it was important to be able to show a multifaceted picture of what it is like to be an African living on this continent at this time. And it was important to kind of cut down all the different kind of issues that we deal with, not only as women, but just as individuals, the kind of personal choices that we make. And so that's why I think my books tend to be so varied in the types of topics that they tackle, because it's just very exciting for me to be able to show us as more than just one thing, because I feel like too often we are typecast as like a whole kind of population, like an ethnic group. We're kind of typecast to be like one thing, like just pick one thing to be in one decade. You're going to be the angry Black women this decade. Okay, fine. Next decade, what are we, you know? So, and we're much more than that, of course, and we all know that.
I know, like, lots of people have potentially asked you this question, but we really need an answer. Is there going to be a sequel to Red Ink?
Oh, my goodness. You love this question, I know.
Do you know, my friend and I were talking about Red Ink the other day, and we just, like, no. Angela did not leave us.
We need to know what happened. She left us.
You can't. Remember, no, guys.
I know.
Can everyone in the comments please support me? I know you all want a sequel to Red Ink. I need all of you to please peer pressure Angela to give us a sequel to Red Ink, because she is not allowed to.
I hate this Red Ink question, hey?
Do you get asked often about the sequel to Red Ink?
Jeez, I think almost everyone who's read and loved Red Ink has come back to me, has gone and sent me either a text or an email. Some have stalked me and have said, we need to know what happens next. So, and I don't, and the sad thing is I actually don't have an answer to this question, because I think my mind, it just works at a strange kind of pace. Like, I'm always wanting something new to write about. And so I think it'll always be challenging for me. I mean, I've had people talk about, you know, approach me to write series, you know, serialized books. And I know that there's just something in my process, in my creative process, that wants a beginning and an end. And I think my mistake with Red Ink, which is why it's haunting me, is because I did not give people a satisfactory end. I gave people an open-ended end, which is why people keep on wanting to know what happens next. So we'll see. Maybe, you know, as you evolve as a writer, as I evolve as a writer, that window of, you know, continuity may open up. You know, and when it does, you'll be the first to know that Red Ink 2 is
coming. Look, I'll even take a movie where you just finish.
Where I tell you what happens next. Okay, so yeah, maybe so... that's a good compromise that we could work towards, you know? Maybe, yeah, that could
you
be
know
a good
someone
compromise.
is saying people love closure. I actually don't even love closure. I don't believe in closure. I'm team
You
delete and
just
block.
care. You just care about the fact that this guy is running around Johannesburg.
Do you know what it is? It's that he like lived in my head, right? He was in my head at the end of this book, and I guess that's just a testament to an amazing book that he lived in my head, and I was like, get him out. But I see there's some haters in the comments, like Ziggy Self, who are anti my sequel movements. I'm just gonna ignore them.
Thank you, Zuki. Life must go on.
I'm just ignoring Zuki right now because bye. But people saying if you do a sequel, she will disown you as a friend.
Why?
Wow, everyone is like anti.
Sorry, no sequels. Yes, my favorite professor has endorsed it. Case closed.
You know what? When two of my faves are like anti this continuation of
team delete and block. She says no sequels. That's like the fourth person who said no sequels. So I don't think you're winning this battle. Where are my stalkers? They must come and help you with your cause.
I know that people on the inside are like wanting to know about Red Ink, but they just feeling pressured now. It's fine, guys. We're talking the DA.
Oh, shame. They're all abandoning you, hey? There's so many no sequels. She's shame, man. This is really sad, hey?
Do you know what it is? It's fine. It's okay.
You see, you're not a good activist. You should have formed a group before going online. And like, okay, bring back Red Ink. And then, you know, your guys, your people would have been blasting, you know, our IG.
The thing is, people stay blasting you in the DMs. I don't know why they're getting on Instagram. And
they're shy. They're shy.
But I can't do my Facebook group is coming.
Pressure is a very sad thing.
Yeah. My Facebook group is coming. I see all of y'all. But I guess, you know, I really want to talk about...
I'm seeing so many laughing emojis, eh?
People are laughing at my pain, but I can't do, guys. I can't do. So I actually want to talk about Blessed Girl, which is your latest novel. Well, it's not your latest novel. You've got your fifth novel that you're working on. But Blessed Girl, firstly, we need to begin by... I sort of congratulate you. Blessed Girl... was announced on the long list for the Comedy Woman in Print Prize in April this year, which is amazing. Congratulations.
Thank
what are your
you.
Thoughts about this long listing? How do you feel?
I think for me, the most important thing that I am taking out of, you know, having this book long listed for that prize is the fact that there is now a realization that you could have kind of a subcategory. So this goes to show that you can't, you know, you can't just section off women's literature as chick lit, you know. Some of us write comedy, some people like write drama, some people write thrillers. So for me, the most affirming thing about just the existence of even this prize is realizing that people are now waking up to the fact that women are not just like being a woman is not a genre. You can't call being a woman a genre, because that's what calling women's fiction or women or chick lit, that's what categorizing something as women's literature does. Mm-hmm. So what I love about, you know, just the existence of this prize is the fact that we are starting to have the recognition that we are all writing with different voices, different styles, different genres. So that is the most exciting thing to me about the prize.
So, James, we've got some questions. I'm ignoring Zigisa, but I see you. We need the sequel. Yes, I agree. James is asking, what was that postscript to The Blessed Girl about?
What's that? James is right. Is asking.
James is asking, what was the postscript to The Blessed Girl about?
Which postscript?
Okay, I'm gonna ask James to just expand in the comments. People are saying Blessed. Rushka is saying Blessed Girl was so funny. Some of the things that were said, and Zigis was saying Troy just said that if we'd been the Twitter generation of writers, you'd have been the writer twerking on Twitter.
What kind of nonsense is that? Just because I wrote Blessed Girl, now I'm a twerker. He must explain himself.
And feminist or so proud from that saying, being a woman is not a genre. We need to make a t-shirt. Yes. So before we even go far, what do you think Winter would be doing during COVID?
Oh my goodness. She'd be trying to sell hair online. And of course, you know, the uptake would be very low because we all just chilled and staying home. And then she'd be texting Papa Jeff, who'd be on lockdown. And, you know, Mrs. Papa Jeff obviously has Papa Jeff's phone right now. And then she would try to hit up Mr. Emmanuel, who wouldn't even be in South Africa and can't fly to see her because he's in New York, you know, kind of chasing his oil company and trying to keep it afloat. And then, of course, she would try the teddy bear and hope that he'd give her tenders for the masks or the latest gloves, you know. And then, of course, Teddy would say to her, but you messed up the construction tender. I can't trust you anymore, you know. So it would be a very, very tricky time for Bonje right now.
Okay, so...
And she wouldn't be twerking. Okay, she wouldn't be twerking because I don't think she's a twerker.
But she'd be smuggling men in the complex for extra
wild. Oh my goodness. Somebody's more inventive than I am.
So there's a question here, which I think really ties in nicely to, I guess, the conversation we're having about the Blessed Girl also being published internationally and the different endings that you had for the international publication and the South African publication. So why did you decide to have different endings for the two books?
It wasn't my decision, to be honest. So Bloomsbury Publishers, my UK publishers, they had an issue with my South African ending. And I struggled to reconcile myself with that, you know, request or that question. So the main issue was that, you know, it's not a happy ending. You've read Blessed Girl. It's not a happy ending. And I've also had feedback from my local readers that, you know, did things really have to end up so badly for her? And so, you know, we had a long back and forth in the editing process because I wanted my kind of happy median in that negotiation. And I still insisted that I can't have kind of a Hollywood ending where, you know, she ends up with the guy and she's happy ever after and she's riding off into the sunset, because it's just not what I had in mind for the kind of book that I wanted to bring out. You know, for me, there were some key kind of social issues that I wanted to underline with it. And, you know, some people are not happy with that, but, you know, with some of the messaging around the book. But for me, it was important. And obviously it's open to debate because books are there for us to debate and, you know, there's no one way of looking at it. But, you know, so in the end, I kind of the ending is not as dire as the South African ending, but it's very similar. It's just a few tweaks that led to a slightly different outcome for Bundle. So when you read them, they're not two totally different books, but they make you think about Bundle's situation. They make you ponder it in different ways. It's kind of like a sliding doors kind of thing. You know, I don't know if you watched that movie, Sliding Doors, where you go through the same things, but then if you make a certain turn, the outcome is just slightly different because of like a slightly different decision or choice that you made at that particular point in time.
So I just want to talk a little bit about the South African ending. I found... It was such a sad ending. I understand that it was realistic, or that people felt that the ending was realistic. But I'm really curious about the ending. You said that you wanted to highlight social issues. Can you just talk a little bit about why you felt that Bunte's story ended the way that it did?
So this is where I get slammed a lot. But, you know, as writers, often we say we don't want to be judgmental towards our characters, and it's a very it's a very positive kind of outlook to that creative process. But I also feel, you know, as a member of our society, I mean, obviously I'm a member of the society, and I feel that there's certain, when certain anomalies become norms, and nobody speaks up, and we kind of accept because we are saying that you're embracing your liberties, you're expressing yourself, you're, you know, enjoying your body and everything else. I still feel that there needs to be some caution, and it doesn't have to be necessarily preachy. We don't need to be preachy about cautioning young people about the kind of choices that they make in life. And so that's why even the tone of the book is so, it comes across as light, but it's actually not. And I think some people pick up on the satire and recognize it for what it is. Mm-hmm. And some people kind of are dismissive and think this is kind of a light, fluffy novel, but it's not. Because there's a lot of deep issues that I address in the book. And one of the issues that people kind of make fun of now when people are living in this kind of lockdown. There's a big narrative that's going around like, oh, what happened to all the slay queens? Now they're living their real lives. And, you know, people kind of poking fun at people in that lifestyle. And the way that I approach it in the book is such that I want to reflect that some of it is real, some of it is not. But that the people living that life, some of them do buy into that illusion to the extent that they lose themselves in the illusion. And that is why, you know, Bunte's life unravels in the way that it does, because she kind of misses the moment where she can separate illusion, you know, like being the master of the illusion, and being kind of a victim of it, being caught up in it and not recognizing that I'm putting this show on for people, but I know myself. Like when I'm sitting down alone as Bontle, I know where the bullshit ends and where it begins. And so the reason that her life ends up being the way it is because she kind of missed the opportunity, as smart as she is, and she is a clever girl, is that she missed the opportunity to recognize where she's playing us, and ends up kind of playing herself. You know, and I think that's kind of an important distinction that I wanted to kind of underline with this. And that's why it kind of ended as badly as it did, because I feel like sometimes if we don't underline it, people end up thinking that we've bought into the illusion and that we can't see what's really happening, you know. And then they think that we enjoy the illusion, you know, and then they become victim to it.
So there's a question here, and I guess it will tie in with what I wanted to talk about. There's a question about what was the writing, what was the inspiration for Blessed Girl? Was it based on somebody that you know? Were there people who recognize themselves in the book? Okay, all right. So
I'm scared of lawsuits.
So
it was inspired by, you know, what I see, people that I've interacted with, like, personally. And I think maybe that's why there was that element of, you know, me wanting it to be a cautionary tale, because I think as a Black woman, I'm invested in what happens to younger women around me. I'm invested because I care. I'm invested because I want the best outcome. And so maybe there was a bit of, you know, being a mama bear involved in that. I don't know, but it did come from a genuine concern.
So I want to talk about Ubuntle. Ubuntle as a protagonist, the story is written from Ubuntle's perspective. However, interesting or like flawed that you think Bunte's perspective is, because she comes across sometimes initially as a little bit superficial, right? So you read it and she's telling us about how she knows about mincology. You know, Bunte as a protagonist is very, very interesting. Why do you think that, firstly, why do you think that it was important for the story to be written from Bunte's perspective in the way that it does, that it is, but also just to take us through Bunte as a character. She's so multifaceted. Just when you want to write her off as just being the superficial, like not so intelligent person, she continuously reveals layers of herself that prove otherwise, right?
I think the reason, and this is the only character, well, the only book that I've written in first person. And I think it's because I recognized judgment from myself as a person and as a writer. And so I felt that it was important for me to be able to remove judgment. I had to walk in her shoes. I had to be her. And I had to think like her. And I had to understand her choices. And by so doing, it actually helped me deepen like the complexity of the character. Because by doing that, I could then pose a question to myself. Why am I, maybe one of the reasons why I'm like this, I, Bontle, is it could be something to do with my childhood, my background, or it could be to do with trying to enhance an image that people may already have of me. And because I have been swept up by it, I don't know how to be any other way, and I also, that actually, I pushed myself even further with the UK version, because with the UK version, I was forced to find another way for her, which was actually quite a, it was a very humbling process in a way, because I think that book, that version of the novel kind of gives her even more humanity. And without taking away anything from South African readers who read this South African novel, but it does give her back a lot of some of the humanity that maybe because of this ending, that is so sad, that I didn't afford her to kind of try and turn a different corner. The corner that she turns is not like vastly different. It's not like she kind of went and, I don't know, changed her choices or whatever. She did almost everything that she did, but the moment that I said, you can miss in life, where you're saying, okay, yes, this is an illusion that I've created, but like, is this really me? That moment when you sit with yourself and you just kind of introspect and say, like, is this all that I have to offer myself and the world? And so that's what she does differently in that book. And I think artists, I think that's why maybe creativity and expression is so important, because when you get into a creative process, you take away a lot of the layers of how of judgment that you use in the lens that you view the world. Because when you go deeper inside yourself and you try to place yourself in a different circumstance or a different character or a different context, whether you're painting or you're singing or whatever kind of artistic expression it is, you really do have a deeper empathy just for others, for other humans, for humanity. And that's one of the biggest things that I've come out with, from being a writer, from being somebody who expresses myself in that particular way, that I find humanity in people and in contexts that maybe, through the superficial lens that we all, because we're so busy, we just, it's easy to judge, it's easy to kind of put people in boxes and stuff like that. But when you go inside yourself, even as an artist, then you peel away those layers and you try and see the person for who they really are, for like their true, their essence. And that's kind of one of the bigger outcomes of that process of writing this particular character.
I think that it's so interesting that you've spoken about how in the other version you wanted to give her an opportunity to turn the corner, right? Because I often think of how grace is not really afforded to Black women, right? So I think that people have space for every other person to make mistakes, but I often think of how people behave when Black women make mistakes, whether it's Black women that they admire or not. I often feel like there's just such a small window of grace and of understanding, and people are just so much harsher in their judgment, so much harsher in the way that they would view the mistakes that Black women make in ways that they may not necessarily for anybody else.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I know that, you know, anyone who's listening to this obviously just thinks about recent developments. And it's a strange thing because it's almost as if, you know, Black women, we are expected to fail, not only by others, but also by Black women and Black men, you know? And so you find that somebody who's been put on a pedestal because of maybe, you know, kind of their intellectual output or artistic output or whatever it is, if they do just that one little thing, you know, wolves come out, you know, and you find that you've got enemies that you didn't even know existed, like the people that you thought were in your corner suddenly turn into your worst critics. And I don't know if it's because society has failed to kind of cultivate safe spaces for us to just be ourselves once and all. And I think that's why when I try to portray my characters, I mean, they always have some kind of flaw. Like, they're not perfect, perfect, you know? And I always look at, you know, English, and this is the thing, I don't know if I'm meandering off topic here, but I always look at, especially when you know, the UK publisher was saying, oh, you know, but we want a happy ending and all that. Mm-hmm. And you find kind of European heroines, especially in a romantic, in women's fiction or women's literature, whatever you want to categorize it as, they're usually very insecure, you know, about their butt. Is my butt too big? Have I gained weight? Have I not gained? Have I shed? You know, that's usually kind of the running insecurity. And, you know, with Black women, maybe it's the fact that Black women, when they are confident in themselves, they're actually scarily confident, you know. It's very rare that even, you know, a confident black woman who is, according to Western standards, kind of overweight, when you see women who have beautiful, curvaceous bodies express themselves, there's no insecurity, like there's no room for it. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe I'm obviously trying to understand this, but I think maybe it is because that when Black women are confident of who they are, it's a fierce confidence. It's a scary confidence. It's like a fire that, you know, can't be extinguished. And I think people are scared of that. I think as people prefer people to always show how vulnerable they are. Don't be too confident because we're gonna bring you down. Because you're overdoing this. You're too confident. You're too full of yourself. So I think that's why we're always so ready to kind of cut down to pieces any Black woman who kind of manages to soar, you know, above the limits that we think are enough. Like you can be great, but you can be good, but don't be great. Because now, or you can be great, but don't tell us how great you are, because then you're going to piss us off and we're going to cut you down to size, kind of thing. It's kind of that.
Because
kind
he
of
has born, right? How dare you?
Yeah, because he has born. And Black women have that thing when they're confident. They can't, like when Black women are confident, they're confident. They don't make excuses about how confident they are. And if they think they're smart, they'll say, I think I'm smart. I know I'm smart, you know?
I wonder about that whole confidence thing being used in the context of Black women, because I think if you've ever encountered a mediocre, straight white man who knows absolutely nothing about any field that you may be in, there is a confidence that is unmatched, right? That kind of mediocre white man has that nobody will ever comment
question.
On. I don't know if we are necessarily scarily confident, so if there's just an expectation on us not to be confident. No. If you,
or you think it's a fear of that confidence. You think
potentially.
You think it's a fear of that confidence, or it's an irritation with the confidence? Like, why are you confident?
I think it's potentially an irritation with it, because these are the same people who would not feel any type of way about how confident mediocre white men are in any space that they enter, right? And just feel like you are an expert. So that's why you can be an expert on educational psychology, but want to speak on the epidemiology of COVID-19 and not have anybody question where your confidence would emanate from, right? And mediocre as you are. So it's always interesting to see how people perceive Black women being self-assured, Black women being assertive, Black women really just being self-assured. It's always interesting to see the same people's reactions, right?
Yeah.
So our Instagram is very generous. It's about to kick us out. Can I ask if we can just borrow a little bit more of your time? Because I really want to talk about this long-listed novel, which is just delving into the wonders of our time.
I want to talk about my new novel too.
Yes. So we also want to talk about your new novel. We want to talk a little bit more about Wuntle before everybody in the comments kills me, because everyone loves Wuntle. But we also want to know about your new novel. We want to know what's next, what are we awaiting. We just basically want to know everything about you.
Okay, so I just wanted to have a small moment to plug my manuscript. It's not even a novel yet. The working title, which you can't see, but I'm forcing it anyway because I'm an overly confident Black woman.
Yes, and you're going to tell us more about it. I'm going to save this live, and then we'll start a new one, and we're going to talk more about this new novel because we want all the juice.
Say that again. Sorry, my kids are... Okay.
So Instagram's going to kick us out just now. So I'm going to start a new live, and I want to talk about your new novel. I want to talk about this manuscript that you're holding. We want to talk about next. So I'm going to end this live, and I'm going to start a new one.
Cool.